The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Rain-soaked Jubilee may be over, but the sun never sets on the financial crisis. The experts give Europe mere weeks to save the single currency, but will Germany agree to pick up the bill? David Cameron's on his way to Berlin as world leaders call on Angela Merkel to use her economic might to face down the markets. So are European taxpayers willing to agree that they really are all in this together? Also this week, as the ministerial code advisor gets his very first case, we refer Conservative Chair Lady Wasi to our very own panel on parliamentary double standards. Joining me for all of this, we have the economics editor of The Observer, Heather Stewart, The Guardian's Philip Alterman, who's the author of Keeping Up with the Germans, and our political stalwart, Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, as the Prime Minister touches down in Berlin, he's only got one objective: heap more pressure onto the German Chancellor Merkel and convince her that a German rescue of Europe is now the only credible way out of the crisis. As Spain's banks teeter and Italian bonds get ready to burst, one thing is clear: Europe as a whole has the capacity to fight off the bond markets, but whether or not it has the collective will is what is about to be tested. Well, I say all of that, Heather, but people have been saying similar things for pretty much 2 years now. Oh, now we're at crunch point. Now it's all going to go wrong. They're going to have to make a decisive move or it's all game over. And in fact, what we've had is a series of sticking plasters being applied, which have lasted for just long enough to get us 3 months down the road till the same sort of thing happens again. So what I want to ask you really is, can we be sure that something really bad will happen if they don't do something? And what? What exactly will happen?
I think, well, you're absolutely right that we have heard this before. You know, George Soros said at the weekend that we've got 3 months to save the euro. We've certainly heard that before. And I think we've had a month to save the euro previously. So you're right to be sceptical. The reason we should be very worried at this point is because previously the crisis was largely isolated to Greece, which, you know, is having a horrendous time of it, very deep recession, very high unemployment, you know, very difficult to know whether it's going to hit its targets and so on. But it's a very small economy, and the politicians in the larger countries, in Germany and so on, could just about plausibly argue, do you know what, we can let Greece go, it's not doing what we've told it to, we can let it go and we can contain it, and it won't be the end of the world. However, now we're talking about Spain. It was a pretty extraordinary moment when the Spanish government has now had to admit that it cannot afford to fix its own banking sector, that it needs some external help. So there's now a big row going on about how exactly Spain can be helped, how that can be afforded, whether it can be done in a way that's acceptable to both the Germans and the Spanish, I mean, and indeed to the other countries that have been bailed out in a very sort of strict and short-term way, Portugal, Greece and Ireland, which likely to feel a bit cross if Spain gets a better deal. But the reason we should be so worried about this now is because Spain is a much, much bigger economy. It's an integral part of the Eurozone, and it would be very, very hard to let Spain go or you know, to let Spain fall without it tearing the whole single currency apart. As, you know, Mervyn King has suggested, that's exactly what may happen.
And when you say let it go, I mean, because, you know, we've been talking about letting Greece go for a long time, it hasn't happened yet. Do you sort of mean we'd end up with five or six Northern Rocks going on at once in Madrid?
Yes.
And then the banks.
Yes, well, you would probably end up with, it would start off with several Northern Rocks in Spain, but then very quickly you would see the banking sector drying up. If you remember what happened after the Lehman Brothers collapsed, early, we had this problem of what was called counterparty risk, which means that no one knows what anyone else owes to a third person. And so, you know, nobody knew who was sitting on great losses from Lehman, and the bank's understandable response to that is just to stop lending. So the financial sector right across Europe would be likely to kind of seize up. And central banks pumped enormous amounts of liquidity into markets to deal with that last time around. They can do that again to some extent, but they haven't got quite so much ammunition left because they've been throwing money at the system for the last, you know, 4 years now.
And then very quickly, people are talking about this idea of a grand bargain because Spain doesn't want to be bailed out in the same harsh terms that Greece and Ireland and others were. So what would be the sort of two or three elements of this big bargain between the European Central Bank and the Germans on the one hand and the Southern Europeans on the other?
Well, first of all, I'd say you have to be a little bit sceptical because grand bargains and comprehensive solutions and various other phrases have been talked about quite a lot in the past. But one element of it is already in place, which is this fiscal pact that the Germans were very, very insistent on late last year, which means that governments will have to put into their constitutions or into law the fact that they will try to balance their budgets over a very short period of time. So Germany, that gives Germany a little bit of comfort about kind of fiscal discipline. There are also ideas floating around that have been floating around for a while about some sort of Eurobond, some sort of acceptance that there would be common issuance of debt. Maybe it would only cover a certain percentage of each country's debt, you know, maybe just a chunk of it. But that sort of collective responsibility for some of the worst debts of the most indebted countries would help to calm the markets because they would realise there was someone else standing behind, you know, Spain or Greece or Italy. And the other bit is about fixing the banking system. So there's talk of Spain's banks or Spain's banking bailout fund receiving direct help from the Eurozone bailout fund, which is called the European Stability Mechanism, which comes into operation at the beginning of July. That's got or is due to have 500 billion euros in it. So it's big enough to fix the Spanish banking system. But there are all sorts of technical questions about whether it's allowed to bail out banks directly, whether that would have to go through the government. If it did go through the government, what kinds of conditions would Germany insist could be attached?
So it sounds, Mike, like we've got from the German point of view what would be written up as free money, and from the south of Europe's point of view, austerity forever. You've got a passing acquaintance with many of the Europeans' leaders. Did you reckon they're up for being able to pull something off like this and then sell it?
Well, they've got to sell it to the markets and they've got to sell it to their electorates, and they are facing in diametrically the opposite direction. Voters are fed up with austerity. They say, we didn't cause it, we didn't bust the banks. That's not quite right, because anybody who borrowed against their home or who racked up a lot of private debt one way or the other, whether they were companies or individuals, enjoyed the good times and are now part of the problem in the bad times. What worries me is the old problem, which Guardian writers like Heather bang on about all the time, and they're quite right. If people in the private sector, whether they're companies or individuals and families, trying to pay down their debts, pay off their credit cards, deleverage, as they say in the expensive world, at the same time as governments are trying to deleverage, then we just push ourselves further into a recession depression. What's the answer? I don't know. I read the financial pages every day, and it's pretty clear that the Nobel Prize winners and the finance ministers and all the rest of it don't know either. But when I hear Heather talk about accepting the German terms, the new fiscal compact, which means balancing your budgets, I go, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, because if everybody behaved like the Germans, who are very proper in their prim, righteous way about setting a good example, then we'd all go bust, including the Germans. Why is that? Because the Germans loaned the Greeks and the Spaniards all the money with which to buy German cars, very nice while it lasted, and now, like Wonga or Bunga Bunga and all those payday loan people, they're asking for the money back and sending around blokes with clubs, you might say, and to get it back. And the Greeks say, well, we can't pay, we're awfully sorry. And the Germans get iffy about it. But the fact is, Germany has benefited enormously from being in the Eurozone, because unlike Greece and Spain, it's had a much cheaper currency than it deserves. Mm. Very good for exports.
Mm. And captive markets in a lot of those countries.
Absolutely right.
I think that's my worry about this, is that even if this grand bargain, as it's called, is pulled off, actually you may not get the immediate financial crisis, but you're condemning these countries to years of slow growth and you know, political problems.
And they can't pay the debt off.
Absolutely.
And when the markets accept that, then the whole thing goes pear-shaped anyway, because the markets are pretty stupid in their own way.
Phil, in Germany, do you think that this argument that Heather and Mike are both making in different ways, you know, that in the end, as Keynes said about the Versailles debts, these debts cannot and will not be repaid. Is that argument resonating at all now? Or is there an expectation that actually, despite the write-offs to Greece and the rest of it, that if you push hard enough, you can get the rest of Europe to pay back what's owed?
I'm sort of half German, half English these days, so I'll do my German bit first, which is, I think, the comeback to the argument that Germany has undoubtedly profited from the Eurozone. I'd say it's a bit more complicated than that. I mean, exports to Greece only make up 0.1% of the German export market. You know, there's a lot of trade going to China, and it, you know, a lot of it is sort of with Britain. I mean, I think, you know, it's another
country which fiddles its currency.
Oh, of course, but we all do.
No, we don't.
And I just, you know, I think that you could also make the argument that German exports, you know, people don't just buy them because they're cheap. You know, a lot of them, they've managed to sort of crowd in on niche markets where other countries just don't produce specialists.
Actually, we have some niche markets too at which we're quite good. How many German aircraft engine have you flown in lately? Not very many.
Don't feel obliged.
Anyway, so I've done my German bit. Without a doubt, if you look at, I just had a sort of flick through the German papers this morning, and it is remarkable. When yesterday we were, I could sort of see the vibe in the newsroom here. There was a sort of mild panic when people were saying, "Oh, you know, the German banks are being downgraded." You know, oh dear, this is we're in serious trouble now. You'd really have to look long and hard through the German papers to see any of that. I mean, I just had a look. Okay, I've got a copy here of Bild, which is, you know, the Danmark tabloid, and there's quite a lot about the Euros. But about the football and not about the financial situation. That's Bild. But, you know, you look on Spiegel, which is the most read news site. There's a big story on Facebook. There's a science story. And then there's a small story about Spain. But, you know, you'd really have to look long and hard to find...
Yeah, but we didn't report much when the Brazilian economy overtook ours. We all play that game.
But what I thought was interesting... Die Zeit, which is the sort of opposite end of Bild, the tabloid, which is a weekly, very lots of text, very few pictures. A big headline there today. It's a big interview with the new president, Joachim Gauck, and the big headline is, "Can one be proud of Germany these days?" And he says, "Yes, that's possible." So I think there's a real sense still, a dangerous sense that it really isn't affected. That, you know, the crisis is happening outside Germany, and, you know, I think for the common voter, just looking at the reaction to Obama and Cameron coming, you know, meeting Merkel, you know, headlines today about them calling for quick action to solve the crisis. I think there's real scepticism towards that, and there's still a sort of quite a dangerous self-satisfaction at the moment. There's a sort of sense that Germany has done the right thing by not being like America and like Britain for the last week. And it might be right to an extent, but the problem might be that it might be sleepwalking into
off a cliff.
Because of that.
Yeah, they think it's an Anglo-Saxon problem. That's why they've been so smug about it. And it's not just the Germans. The zone thought that, but it wasn't. And it's turned out to be a zone problem, roughly the same problem. Too much liquidity, too much unsound borrowing and lending, of course. It takes two to make a loan. And, you know, we're not doing very well because we don't have the political instruments, a government, with which to manage a currency. And that was obvious in the opposition, which many people in The Guardian had to the European currency in the first place. You need some sort of political instrument to control and manage a currency. And you know, the ECB is, to a large degree, prisoner of the national governments, particularly Paris and Berlin, which pull in opposite directions on austerity and expansion, particularly now since François Hollande has been elected.
I mean, is the election of Hollande huge news in Germany, would you say, Philip?
It was, and I think Hollande is being listened to, and I'd still be very surprised if Merkel doesn't make some sort of concession on Eurobonds, for example. Whether that will solve, you know, that will be the quick fix that we're all looking for, I doubt it, but I'd be surprised if nothing happens there. I mean, I think that, I mean, there's a beautiful irony about Cameron and, you know, the American president and the British prime minister coming to Merkel or to the German chancellor and asking for quick action. I mean, one of the, you know, if you look at the big picture, one of the historical ironies is that, you know, America and Britain were very instrumental in building a political system in Germany which is by definition, very slow. It moves things.
Checks and balances.
You can't get things happening very quickly. I mean,
hasn't
been reported much is the fact we're all talking about the fiscal compact that supposedly the Germans want and other people are not so sure about. I mean, it hasn't actually been ratified in Germany yet. Merkel needs 2/3.
It's hardly been ratified anyway, has it?
Well, yeah. And there's going to be a vote later this month, and I mean, if you look at the process, it's so slow. I mean, the Social Democrats are having a big summit about to decide how they're going to vote on it. The Greens haven't made up their mind.
Where are the opposition on austerity and all of that? I mean, is there any solidarity, do you think, from the SPD on position of people in Greece and Spain, or are they kind of just playing hardball against Merkel?
I think they've been keen. The Social Democrats have been keen to get on Hollande's side. And I think there's a big conversation going on between the Social Democrats and Hollande's people. I think they have sort of changed their tune to growth to the same sort of growth song that Hollande's been singing. But you have to also bear in mind that they are, you know, the Social Democrats, they're still fairly fiscally conservative in Germany. They're not, they're not all that far from Merkel. And I think quite a lot of, I mean, I know this when I talk to people in Germany, a lot of people who would vote Social Democrats, you know, they quite like Merkel, and they say it against their own their better judgment, but they're sort of like her reluctance to reluctance against big gestures and her sort of cautiousness, which is exactly what I think everyone else in Europe is getting a bit frustrated with.
But I think if you're sitting in the Bank of England or the Treasury, where you've lived through, you know, the speed with which a banking crisis can take over, if you remember how kind of frenzied and how quickly things moved, you know, through Northern Rock, through RBS and so on, I think they're petrified because, you know, the British system, with all its faults, does allow you to take very quick action. It allows you, you know, to take over a bank over a weekend and announce it on the Monday morning, or, you know, to take very drastic action and you know, throw all your previous plans out of the window. And you know, what terrifies them is that the financial markets, unfortunately, don't play according to that, you know, that rhythm, and can take things out of your hands, you know. And if you get an investor run on a bank, let alone if you get savers queuing up to take their money out, you know, you can't then say, well, it's all terribly complicated and we've got to, you know, each party's got to have discussions and then we've got to ratify it, and, you know, the crisis can be taken out of your hands. And I think that's what terrifies, you know, Mervyn King and people sitting in the Treasury watching this. And, you know, they have no right to lecture the Eurozone. That's absolutely right. Certainly not since Cameron.
Yes, we do. We told them it would go pear-shaped.
Well, we did tell them it would go pear-shaped, but it's not as if we've been a glowing example of financial sector probity,
I don't
think.
We're our own shambles.
Well, very true.
We're going to leave the Eurozone crisis alone for now, even if it's not going to leave us alone. But sure enough, we'll be returning to the subject next week ahead of the new elections in Greece, which take place a week on Sunday. Now, here's a question for you. Who has no desk, no office, and has conducted until now no investigations, but gets paid a princely £20,000 a year for his troubles? The answer, Sir Alex Allen, David Cameron's advisor on the ministerial code. He may have thought that his phone wasn't working in recent weeks as increasingly wild allegations surfaced about the conduct of Jeremy Hunt, the culture secretary. But no call from the Prime Minister came until this week. And Michael White, it wasn't Jeremy Hunt at all that he wanted us to look into, or wanted Sir Alex Allen to look into. It was Saeed Wasi.
It was indeed. It was Baroness Wasi, chairman, or these days co-chairman. I think that's a slight demotion of the Tory party. And the symbol of David Cameron's detoxification, she's the sort of political equivalent of those husky dogs he saw in wherever it was, Spitsbergen. She's a Muslim woman from a working class background whose dad arrived with nothing and worked in a factory and set up a factory of his own to make, I think, furniture, and did quite well. And she was a solicitor plucked from obscurity. She'd had one failed candidacy for Parliament at 36. And she's finding it's pretty hot in the political kitchen. Cameron has referred her, as you say, for an inquiry, and not done that, as you also tactfully point out, Tom, to Jeremy Hunt. I have to say right away, they are very different cases. Hunt is highly technical about what it means to make a quasi-judicial decision on the B Sky B bid. Let's not talk about that again. And Vince Cable has previously had the role and messed up, as everybody knows, and Hunt went to Leveson and explained, not badly, I have to say. I was there all day listening to him making his defense and saying, you know, you put aside your personal prejudices. I employed independent experts. I annoyed James Murdoch, always a good thing to do. And I haven't done anything wrong. It's just that my poor old special advisor was taking all these texts and emails and greasing phone calls from Fred Michel, a News Corporation lobbyist. Well, we'll see how that plays. But it's very different from Lady Wasi, who was accused of our old friend expenses, misappropriation, and also more recently the plot has included a very small food company in which she had an interest which she didn't declare. And I'm afraid I tend to say with these things they are more careless than criminal, and that the newspapers love persecuting people. So when Ken Clark said the pack is in full flight, I tend to agree with him, as I so often do with the nice old gentleman. He was very good at Leveson. But then he's been an MP six times as long as Jeremy Hunt, and boy, did it show. 42 years against seven.
It's got so complicated with the Wasi stuff, I'm not sure I can do a decent precis, but as I understand it, there was a lot of expenses murk of the type that lots of other people, including some in the cabinet, have had, you know, about designating what was the first and second home, what nights you spent where, and whether a middleman got the rent or the landlord, and, you know, normal kind of murky stuff, but no killer facts on expenses. And the referral is over this other thing, where it's that she was a director, as Mike says, or a minority shareholder of this company, which was declared. She went on a business trip, but was declared, but she didn't declare that someone else who she'd declared was also a co-director of this company, a distant relation, had also gone on that trip. What did you make of it? Did it seem like double standards to you?
It struck me as quite small beer, really. I mean, I think had she not declared her shareholding or, you know... wasn't clear to me was, you know, when the allegation surfaced about Liam Fox and this chap, Adam Werity, who'd turned up on endless, you know, he was a minister at the time and he had turned up on endless foreign visits, you know, one felt there was definitely something, there was a bit of, you know, it never quite became clear whether there was a financial interest involved, but it certainly, you know, it felt very wrong. It smelt wrong somehow. It just wasn't clear to me that it was serious enough to merit. I mean, I can see why Cameron might want to refer it, you know, get someone to look at it, but it didn't strike me that she was benefiting greatly in any way financially. It struck me as a bit of a storm in a teacup, unless I'm missing some killer detail that hasn't yet emerged.
No, you're not.
Well, Sir Alex Allen, we'll get to the bottom of it. What did you make of it, Phil?
I mean, I think it just looks quite bad from outside to the voter. I mean, I think it looks like...
Sorry, what looks bad? The
Wasi affair for Cameron, I think, because it looks like he was trying to, you know, look decisive, trying to, like, he's do exactly with Wasi what he didn't do with Hunt. But, you know, you have a sort of the classic split. We have one MP who's, you know, northern, more working class, multi-ethnic in the way that exactly that Hunt isn't, and I think it just doesn't reflect very well at the moment on Cameron. I mean, and I just sort of looking at articles, it does appear that there's a bit of a internal division within the Tories, and there are lots of people who don't particularly like Wasi. I mean, there was an article on Conservative Home fairly recently by the Margaret Thatcher Centre for Freedom saying Wasi's presence at the top of the party ranks send the wrong signal at the time when Britain is fighting a global war on Islamic terrorism. I mean, there's something.
He's actually not very good at the job, I have to say.
You think?
No, definitely not. They can't put her up on the Today programme. It's difficult to do the Today programme, but what you need is a sweeper, someone who can... Margaret Beckett wasn't ever brilliant, but she never dropped the ball, and you could put her on the Today programme and she'd just bat it all down and wouldn't make any mistakes. She wasn't flashy, but she was safe. And... you know, Cameron took a chance on it. It hasn't worked out very well. I don't think the sort of ethnic minority bit, I think Tory activists, most of them get that point now. And she has also said...
Well, the quote Phil just read out sounded,
But, you know, conservative home, you know, it's an activist one. Just because somebody says something, Norman Tebbit says some pretty unpleasant things, but he was rather a successful chairman of the Conservative Party because he could do it. He could pass the any questions test. So there's a bit of politicking to get her, and there may be a sort of racial element in it too. I agree with Heather. I don't think she's done much here, but I don't think she's a very good chairman, and that's at the bottom what it's about.
Mike, just very quickly, I wonder whether part of what Cameron might be trying to do here is just call in Alex Allen on something where actually he's going to come out and say, you know, it all smells of roses, it's all okay. You know, by last weekend, The Independent and us and other people were running pieces, editorials, saying, oh, it's time to abolish Alex Allen and it's not good for him to be drawing this money when he doesn't do anything and he's never allowed to do anything. Well, do you think this is a cunning plan to have him... to have him do a report and come up with the right answer?
Well, it might well be. I don't think they're that crafty. I always say to people, you know, when it looks like some sort of cunning plan, I say they're not that clever and they're not that wicked. It's always a cock-up, not a conspiracy. Alex Allen, the Whitehall's most prominent Grateful Dead fan, has been a bit unlucky. He was carved up in politics, I think probably to be the cabinet secretary. Didn't get the job. They made him high commissioner to Australia. They made him the man. I think he was in charge of the Joint Intelligence Committee or some other frightfully important hush-hush job for a while. There's someone they obviously feel a bit guilty about, and they've given him this job, perfectly nice fella, just, you know, fallen between a lot of floorboards. The job used to be done by the cabinet secretary, but as Guardian readers of the old school will remember, the cabinet secretary did a terrible job on Jonathan Aitken. I mean, so bad and several others too. He just wasn't equipped intellectually to do this kind of investigation, and so they're trying a new model, but as you say, he's not been overworked.
Well, let's see how it comes out when we get the report. But let's leave things there for now. My thanks to Michael White, to Heather Stewart and to Philip Alterman. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio. The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.